Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is... You're listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I am delighted to be joined by Yves Singler. Yves Singler is a Canadian Montreal-based writer. He's a political activist. He's a prolific author. He's got over 11 books now. And he's been featured in many places, including the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the Ottawa Citizen, and the Ecologist. He is just a remarkable human being. Thank you so much for being with us, Yves.
Thanks for having me.
You've been someone who I've admired for a long time. And one of the things that I love about you is the way you bring us to what matters. You know, so many histories are silenced in the making of the history of empire, like Canada. In Canada, we associate ourselves with peacekeeping, with, you know, this very egalitarian and even inclusive society. And yet, when we think about our history abroad, our participation in the oppression of other peoples, that doesn't really make the mark. So can we talk a little bit about our role in the history of the Haitian people? Because Haiti is one of those remarkable places, the first place to abolish slavery, and they paid a huge price for it. So in your recent article, you bring us back to this place and the importance of our role and what is being done in our name in other places and with Haiti specifically.
I mean, Haiti, of course, is the place that that abolished racial slavery in the Americas decades and decades before elsewhere. And they fought a very, very violent and intense war, which ultimately defeated the French, the British, and the Spanish empires, with Americans at different periods backing different factions. Canada helped the British. John Graves Simcoe, who was actually famous, and there's a Simcoe Day in Ontario, who was actually cited as having helped end slavery in Canada. He actually led the reimposition of slavery during the Haitian Revolution, and boats from Halifax supported the British effort to reinstall slavery in Haiti and to turn it into a British colony. So the Haitian Revolution is just probably the greatest example of human liberation in the history of humanity. But it had immense geopolitical consequences, effects, and obviously played a big role in leading to the abolition of slavery more generally. But Haiti has basically been punished since that time, and was formally isolated by the U.S. for 60 years. There's lots of history that the French forced the Haitians to pay a debt of independence, so that those who liberated themselves by force of arms were then forced to pay French slave owners for lost property. The lost property was the land and the slaves themselves, which had a hugely damaging effect on Haitian economic and political life. It took Haiti more than 120 years to pay off that debt of independence, or ransom of independence, because the French forced the threatened to reinvade, to force Haiti to pay. So there's this, you know, there's a long history that's very fascinating, Haitian history. And the Haitian Revolution, of course, is one of the most, you know, fascinating historical events really ever. But to bring us up to today and Canada's role specifically, there's a mass protests that have erupted over the past couple of weeks. Not just in Port au Prince, in cities all across the country. And there's Lecaille and Digoave and Cap-Haïtien. There's been major demonstrations. And basically, they're, well, our media will never say this, they're basically protesting the Canadian U.S. installed leader. And as hard as this might be to believe, the person who they're protesting, who's leading Haiti today, was actually put in place through a tweet. Basically, after Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, the president just over a year ago, there were three different individuals who claimed that they were the rightful individual to take on, to continue on, to lead the country. And the core group, which is a group of U.S., France, Canada, Germany, the Organization of American States, UN, and European Union representatives. And it's been really the body that's had an incredible amount of influence at some points, determinant level of influence within Haiti over the past two decades, really. And basically, that core group, which is obviously U.S. is the main power, but Canada's the secondary power in Haiti, they decided that Ariel Henry was the rightful leader. There was no constitutional basis for this. He doesn't have any popular support. He's not somebody who's well liked. And they decided through a statement that was posted on Twitter that Ariel Henry was the rightful leader, and the other two main figures within the PHTK ruling political party fell into line with what the core group wanted. And since that time, since Henry has been in office, things were already a very difficult situation, have just deteriorated. And there's been major protests, and the Canadian government over the past couple of weeks has really led an effort to bring international interest and involvement in Haiti. And they do this under the guise of helping Haiti. But if you look at the recent history of the past two decades, it goes back further than that, but the past two decades is very clear. Canada has consistently supported the most reactionary elitist factions within Haiti, violent factions, drug running, corrupt political factions. And that's what they're continuing to do today. So they're saying that we need to have foreign intervention because there's growth of gang violence and there's insecurity problems. But the Canadian government has been promoting the political forces and the political factions in Haiti that are the most inclined towards violence and inclined towards corruption. And on the other hand, they have undermined those political forces that are challenging, that are able to put forward a different vision of a more egalitarian, a more functional country. And the most obvious way in which they did that was by overthrowing an elected government, and not just an elected president, but thousands of elected officials back in 2004, and installing this coup government that killed thousands. And Canada was involved in the planning of the coup, bringing together the international forces 13 months that would later orchestrate the ouster of the elected government. And Canada has, throughout the last 20 years, has consistently, at a whole bunch of different moments, as I detail in the article, when there are popular forces that are trying to change the political reality of the country, to take it out of the hands of the 12 or 15 oligarchic families that basically control the economy, that dominate the politics. Whenever there's political movements that are mobilizing, that are going in that direction, the Canadian government consistently supports the status quo, consistently supports those who turn to violence to repress the protesters and the social movements. And we're seeing it right today. So on one hand, the Canadian government says it's trying to help Haiti out, and all this high-minded, where the Bob Rae, Canada's ambassador to UN, goes to Haiti, then he goes to the Dominican Republic, then he speaks with the head of the United Nations, Secretary General of the United Nations. All of this, he said, he's on Haiti, he goes to the Dominican to speak with Haiti. Two issues he talks to the Secretary General about, Ukraine and Haiti. But they can't say anything about the fact that the Canadian trained, armed, financed police force has been killing people, protesters, in recent days, right? They never release a statement saying, the police shouldn't be killing people, because they basically support the police killing people, because the police are killing people to maintain the status quo. And Canada is a, you know, after the U.S., the most important power in entrenching this unjust status quo in Haiti, where a handful of families control the economy and the vast majority of people are completely impoverished.
One of the things you said, and I really appreciate you reminding us of that, is of the odious debt. You know, we always think about the third world, people say, you know, there's no such thing as a third world. In many ways, that was created by these odious debts that people had to pay for liberating themselves from the genocide and in slavery that, you know, they were under. And in many ways, we still continue there, you know, because the Monroe Doctrine, you know, which came to say that Latin America was the U.S. backyard, and, you know, so they get to exploit and do whatever they want. And so in many ways, remembering, you know, why people struggle is part of our path to reconciliation. If we're able to create a world where workers can see each other as allies, you know, not on opposite trenches. Can you talk a little bit about, we briefly went over the fact that there was a coup in 2004, the one that removed Aristide from power and elected president. And I want to talk a little bit about why that moment has been so significant, because when you have a country where the people no longer are able to rule themselves, whether you do it by NGOs or whether you do it by the presence of the United Nations, which is a military arm of the United States. Can we talk about the significance of that infantilization at the political level of a society?
Yeah, I mean, the coup in 2004, the significance was that you had the most popular politician in the history of Haiti as president. You had a political party, the Famille Lavalas party of Aristide, that had won 80% of some 7,000 elected positions across the country, municipal mayors, you know, Congress, everything. And you had the really modest political platform of change, of, you know, the historically excluded having a bit more say over political life. And so the coup wasn't really just designed, and the coup, you know, it culminated on February 29th, 2004 with the elected president ousted, but basically throughout the whole time of the government, they were doing everything they could to sabotage. I mean, like, you know, there's this economic destabilization that the Canada and the U.S. were doing by cutting off loans that had already been agreed to by the Inter-American Development Bank. There was a military component to it, where former military, basically mercenaries, were coming in from the Dominican Republic and killing Famille Lavalas people. They killed a whole bunch of people toward close to the border with the Dominican elected officials. They actually even took in late 2001, they actually took the presidential palace for a short period of time in this coup effort. So the whole time there was a sort of destabilization on that front. Then you have Jean Chrétien, Canada's prime minister at the time, demonizing Aristide at the Summit of the Americas. So there's this sort of international demonization campaign. Basically, they're doing everything they can to avoid the government that's overwhelmingly popular, overwhelmingly elected, from being able to pursue modest reforms that would take away a bit of the power of the oligarchic families who are mostly light-skinned in this country that's entirely 99% black, that are completely integrated with foreign powers and foreign corporations. So, for instance, the head of the opposition, sweatshop owner André Appède, was the main subcontractor for Gildan Activewear, which is a Montreal-based apparel, you know, sweatshop company. And they weren't happy when the Aristide government doubled the minimum wage. So you have a system of incredibly unjust system in place, and this government trying to redress minimally, again, this is not like a revolutionary government, but modest reforms, and basically being attacked in every different way. So the coup was one, getting rid of government we didn't like, but it was also just destroying a whole political infrastructure that, quite frankly, there was no other political party in the hemisphere that had the level of popular support that Fami Lavalas had. You look at, you know, the Bolivarian revolution in Venezuela, and at the height of the Bolivarian revolution, you know, you had Chavez winning like 60, I think, around below 60% of the vote, and you know, you clearly had a, you know, quite popular process taking place. But in Haiti, you know, the Aristide's popularity, you know, far surpassed that, and the, you know, the opposition boycotted the presidential election because they knew they were going to lose. We don't know exactly how popular, you know, he was, but it's probably into the 75%, 80% kind of range of what he would have won in a fully open and fair election. So the point was to, you know, crush this political party / movement of the poor, and it was to, you know, reentrench the oligarchic class, and also foreign domination. And that's where you bring in the, you know, UN. It was a foreign force that overthrew the government, and then it was a UN occupation force for 17 years. And that UN occupation force had incredible impact on Haitian political life. And like right up until today, when we have a situation where a leader is essentially being imposed by a group of foreign representatives putting out a tweet, I mean, that's a sign of how foreign dominated the country is. And that's the result of, you know, the 2004 coup, the UN occupation. Obviously there's some other factors, you know, things like the earthquakes have further weakened Haitian, you know, capacity and independence. And quite frankly, incredibly, and just sort of, to describe how morally corrupt they are, that if you look at what the Canadian government's reaction to the terrible earthquake of 2010 was, precisely to be fearful that to send armed troops to block the possibility that Aristide, who was then in exile in South Africa, that he would return to the country, but also was to take advantage of the weakness. Right, to when, you know, the earthquake further weakened Haitian capacities and sovereignty, and the Canadian U.S. government played their advantage. So, you know, when, you know, tens and even hundreds of thousands were dead, and, you know, just complete destruction in Port-au-Prince, they the powers that run the Canadian U.S. government, you know, use this tragedy to strengthen their hand in the country. So, the consequences are, of these, you know, interventions are not small, and you know, the country goes from one intervention to the next, and one foreign destabilization to the next, you know, you're going to continue having a situation of, you know, incredible immiseration with that context.
You know, when I think about the abolition of slavery in Canada and the U.S., I fear that it simply has taken a different form, you know, and you listen to things like Forbin, where they have the sugar plantations, and right after they wrote the abolition to slavery, they also put in a code that said, oh, but, you know, no person should be enslaved, and unless it is to punish them, right? And of course, the black codes came right after, and it meant all the ways that black people could be punished for misbehavior. And what was the biggest misbehavior? Vagrancy, lack of employment, not being employed. And what happens when you impoverish a country so much? You know what I mean? Like you create this, you create the structure, and then you utilize that to further crush the people and their ability to live with dignity, to break out of poverty, to break out of the misery that they've been forced to live under, because of the, you know, the literally the foundation of this society has been slavery and genocide. Genocide of indigenous people and slave of black people. So let's talk a little bit about Canada's role today, because most people may not talk about Canadian foreign policy being in support of empire or being a corporate government, but that's really what we are. You know, the Canadian government has never been redesigned other than in the image of the of a colony, right? The Queen used to, we still have a representative of the Queen in Canada. And we are literally a place where, you know, people came to exploit the lands, the people, and the genocide of Indigenous people is still very much a legacy that we're living with in Canada. The enslavement of Black people and the continual aggression that takes in the form of, you know, abject poverty that people are forced to live with is still part of that. So let's talk a little bit about today Canada's role, you know, beyond this idea of peacekeeping, you know, beyond this PR that we are a peacekeeping nation. What is really our role in the UN, and why is it important for us to take note?
Well, the Canadian government, the Canadian foreign policy is completely structured to serve the interests of empire. Historically, that was the British Empire. And that's, you know, the creation of Canada and the whole dispossession of Indigenous people is the British Empire extending itself, westward. And then Canada was then, Canadians were helped in conquering different parts of Africa as part of British forces. And there was actually Canadians that were colonial governors of northern Nigeria, of Ghana, of Kenya. People trained at the Royal Military College in Kingston, Ontario, which was training set up in 1876 to train proper white gentlemen, as one historian of the college described it. And they were basically, they had two parts. One, they were going to be officers in British imperialism in Africa and India and elsewhere. And the other part was they were going to subjugate Turtle Island and what's, now Canada. But the other, so that was, Canada was aligned, very deeply aligned with the British Empire until World War II. But since World War II, Canada has very fluidly gone to alignment with the American Empire. And there's really no ruling class that's better integrated with the American ruling class than the Canadian. You see that in all different factions of the Canadian capitalist class, but you also see that with, probably the most obviously, is with the Canadian military and the intelligence apparatus of this country, which are completely integrated with their bigger partners to the south. And they follow, that leads to Canada following U.S. imperial policy. See, it goes from the some of the smallest level of votes at the United Nations and Canada. There's all kinds of histories of voting patterns at the United Nations, and Canada's consistently one of the closest alignments at UN votes with the U.S. But then at a more kind of consequential level of the Canadian military is setting up bases around the world right now, plan to set up 7 bases. They've set up 3 of them formally that are, it's designed to be integrated with the Pentagon's plans. And you see it with, Canadian military operations from, bombing Libya in 2011, going to war with Iraq in the early 1990s, bombing Serbia in the late 90s, Afghanistan. That's totally integrated with the American military machine. Or even more recently, with Canadian operations, Canadians are still fighting and, still involved militarily in Iraq. That's with the U.S. And then again, the Haiti example in 2004 is U.S., French, and Canadian troops that overthrew the elected government, that basically invaded to overthrow the elected government. So Canada has, the Canadian elite see the world and profit from the world in a very similar way to the U.S. elite. And so they, you know, they've set up so many different, you know, alliances, be it NORAD, NATO, and there's dozens, hundreds even, of different accords between the Canadian and American military. So they set up all these alliances that integrate the Canadian military, particularly, but you know, more generally, Canadian, you know, corporate and business and elite interests. That it's sort of, you know, the U.S. doesn't have to like force Canada to join its imperial project. It's just totally integrated into the imperial project, and there's all kinds of factors that help explain that. There's the whole colonial process that Canada's, you know, been part of for you know, centuries. There's simple corporate reasons. There's military reasons. There's racial reasons. There's linguistic elements, cultural. But the long and the short of it is that if you're to set up a map of countries in the world that are most engaged in the U.S. empire's global domination, obviously the U.S. is the number one country, but Canada comes in a pretty close, you know, is it Britain number two? Is it Canada number two? Is it, you know, Canada's right at the center of that imperial global domination, which we should say that, I think this is a study that came out, Americans have invaded pretty much every, there's like three countries in the world that the U.S. hasn't either invaded or had a major, some sort of major military engagement with that country. This is a study that came out about this. And I think it's like since the early 90s, I think it's like 100 different military, international military operations. I think that was what that came out in this study that Americans have engaged in. It's just an incredible list of militarism. And, you know, Canada's not quite as militaristic, but it's right next, close by with the U.S. as it's engaging in its global empire project.
In many ways, the first way to arrest that wave of violence that is being unleashed in our name is to be informed, to become aware. And one way to do it is to read one of your books. Your latest book was Stand on Guard. For whom, right? So as we come to the close of our interview, what would you like to say to our listeners, and how would you empower them? Because sometimes it's easy to feel powerless and to just let somebody else take charge. But really, we have a responsibility to ourselves and to future generations to not leave an empire as the way of things, to create a society that's egalitarian, that has justice for all people and all beings.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that you pointed out is obviously, you know, become informed, but also it's to get organized. And you can do that by, you know, literally setting up a group with like-minded people, or just getting engaged with many of the groups that are already out there.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Sylvia. Likewise.
Thank you for listening to Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an independently produced syndicated radio program made available for free to campus and community radios, and also to the world at latinwavesmedia.com. Please visit the website to hear previous shows, hear about upcoming events, and consider becoming a member for as little as $1 per month.